From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a concert with Brave Combo. The band started off playing polkas, send-ups of polkas, and polka versions of rock hits. Now they play ethnic dance music from around the country. Also today we meet musician and actor John Lurie. Lurie founded the band The Lounge Lizards, and he wrote the music for the movies Down by Law and Stranger Than Paradise, which he also starred in. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg considers what's lost in the translation when we read the subtitles of a foreign film. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. After weekend flights took 700 hostages to freedom in Japan, Europe, and North America, the exodus of foreign women and children came to a halt today as the Iraqis introduced new complications. NPR's Ann Garrels has this report.
Western planes were standing by ready to fly into Baghdad today to pick up more hostages when Iraqi officials withdrew permission, saying foreign airliners are no longer allowed to land in Baghdad unless Iraqi planes are given back their landing rights at foreign airports. An Iraqi spokesman said evacuees could travel overland to Jordan, but despite these assurances, U.S. officials say it's by no means clear if this is in fact possible. And many women and children have not yet been able to obtain the required exit visas. The French government today charged Iraq with deliberately slowing the promised release. Meanwhile, U.S. officials report that another four Americans have been rounded up by Iraqi forces, bringing the total number of Americans actually detained to about 100. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Soviet Foreign Ministry spokesman Gennady Gerasimov said the Soviet Union still believes the best hope for a solution to the Middle East crisis would be a decision by Baghdad to withdraw its troops from Kuwait. Gerasimov told a news conference in Moscow that next Sunday's meeting between President Bush and Soviet leader Gorbachev in Helsinki is evidence of the maturity of the relationship between the two superpowers. The BBC's Kevin Connolly reports from Moscow.
Mr. Gerasimov was reluctant to describe next weekend's Helsinki talks as a summit. The meeting would rather, he said, be informal and without an agenda, a testament to the maturity of the relationship between Moscow and Washington. Whatever they're called, the talks now appear to provide the best hope that a diplomatic solution to the Gulf crisis can still be found. Moscow, alarmed at the possibility that it may escalate into armed conflict, but anxious to remain in step with the West on the issue, is still calling on Iraq, with which it retains diplomatic contacts, to withdraw from Kuwait. Mr. Gerasimov was careful not to echo the concern expressed by some Soviet military officers at the scale of the United States military buildup, only a few hundred miles from the Soviet Union's troubled southern border region. But he said the presence of so many American troops was allowing Iraq to play what he described as the anti-American card in the Arab world, obscuring the original cause of the crisis.
The BBC's Kevin Connolly in Moscow. A radical Palestinian leader is urging Arabs to attack Israeli and Western interests in retaliation for the military intervention in the Persian Gulf. George Habash, leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, spoke to reporters today in Baghdad. He called on Arab liberation groups to boycott and strike at U.S., Western, and Israeli interests. Habash has his headquarters in Syria, a longtime opponent of Iraq. He denied rumors that he's moving his group to Iraq. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the great music pleasures in life is rediscovering a kind of music you'd written off as square or corny. The band that helped rescue the polka for some of us is Brave Combo, and they're here for a concert. Carl Finch organized the band in 1979. There was a heavy dose of irony in their versions of Who Stole the Kishka, but the deeper he got into polkas, the more genuine his affection became. Polkas have led Brave Combo to other ethnic dance musics, and they've managed to turn an old Doors hit into a polka and a Christmas carol into a cha-cha. At the same time, they do oddball versions of seemingly unredeemable pop tunes like The Poor People of Paris. We have the founder of the group, Carl Finch, on accordion, piano, and vocals, Jeffrey Barnes on tenor saxophone and clarinet, Bubba Hernandez on bass, tuba, and vocals, and Mitch Marine on percussion. Welcome, all of you, to Fresh Air. Carl, would you introduce the first tune?
Yeah, this is Jesusita and Chihuahua. It's a traditional Tex-Mex polka, and it goes like this.
One, two, three.
Okay, that's Brave Combo. And while Carl is taking off the accordion and sitting down at the piano, I'll tell you that they record on Rounder Records, and their most recent album is called Humansville. That's great stuff. Were polkas ever forced on you before you started liking them?
No, not at all. In fact, there was a kid that lived two doors down from me who had the accordion forced on him, and I would listen to him practice Lady of Spain or whatever, and would think what an unfortunate little fellow he was. But then later on, and it's funny, I would keep thinking back to that, because when I think about how I didn't have the accordion growing up, and he did, and I felt sorry for him, now I wish that I had some very basic accordion instruction when I was younger. But I sort of fell into the polka, you know, during college.
How?
Shopping bargain bins, going to stores and that sold primarily cutouts, and where I could find records for three for a dollar, and a lot of the records were ethnic records.
I think the next piece we're going to hear is written by Bubba Hernandez, who's the bass player and tubist with the band, and I think you're going to be singing on this as well. Would you introduce it for us?
Okay. This is Laura Cha-Cha-Cha, and it's by us.
It's a cha-cha. Ready? One, a two, a one, two, cha-cha-cha.
You know what I'd like to do? Since you play so many different ethnic dance musics, I'd really like to ask each member of the band what your ethnic background is and if there's a kind of music that you grew up hearing that you either did or didn't like a whole lot when you were young. Bubba, you wrote the last piece. Can we start with you?
Yeah. I'm Mexican-American. I'm from San Antonio and grew up listening to everything. A lot of musicals and, of course, a lot of Mexican music. And came up to North Texas State and did a jazz education there and ran into my fellow members here.
Mitch Marine, drummer with the band.
well, I'm from Peoria, Illinois, and so I guess I was brought up on Southern rock and Aerosmith, basically. And
a long way from the beer barrel polka.
Very, very long way. And then when I went to college, started listening to jazz, and then went to North Texas State, moved down to Denton, and joined the band and started really listening to ethnic music and a lot more stuff.
Jeffrey Barnes, tenor saxophonist and clarinetist.
Okay, my family's from Ohio. We're, I suppose, mainly German and British Isles and American Indian. I listened to classical music coming up and then kind of got to be a blues fanatic when I turned 14.
Carl? And Carl Finch is the founder of the band, piano and accordion.
Let's see. I grew up in Texarkana and started my first rock and roll band in the seventh grade and listened to a lot of Yardbirds, a lot of the British rock and British blues. That was the main influence. Jeff Beck was always a big influence on me. Then I went away to college and decided I wasn't going to play music anymore. I was going to get a degree in art, so I got a couple of degrees in art. Decided I didn't want to do that as a profession and started kind of abandoning all the things that I thought were right and proper in my life and started looking into new directions for value structure and kind of discovered that there was a lot of great music out there that I'd written off. And really no background at all until I kind of was led in the direction of this new music.
Want to do another tune for us?
Sure. This is called Our Imagined Image, and it's about how we sort of act like we think we should act rather than how we really are. All together? One, two, one, two, three, four.
We are so misinformed, we are so insecure, everything's a threat to our imagined image. If there was no concern for our bloated greatness, there would be no ego, there would be no fighting. What are we afraid of? What are we working for? We're left alone in the dark to cultivate our pride. And we are so misinformed, we are so insecure. Everything's a threat to our imagined image.
Jeffrey Barnes.
So insecure, everything's a threat to our imagined image, our imagined image, our imagined image, our imagined image, our imagined image.
An original by Brave Combo, who are with us today for a concert. Well, I want to hear some more of the music of Brave Combo, but first, let's take a short break, and then we'll continue our concert with Brave Combo playing ethnic dance music and some things, some surprises. This is Fresh Air. It's a Fresh Air concert with Brave Combo, and they play dance music of all kinds, and they record on Rounder Records. And Carl, want to introduce the next piece for us?
Okay, this is a waltz. It's a Polish waltz. It's called Breslau, and we just happened to find this from one of those records that I found in a bargain bin. It goes like this.
Brave combo. And, you know, I'm sitting here listening to all this great dance music, and I'm thinking, I could probably tell you all stories that would make your hair stand up about cha-chas and, and polkas and merengues from catered affairs gone by. And I just am so excited about hearing the music kind of taken out of the kind of bad union musician context that I heard it growing up. We have a pretty diverse ethnic background represented in the band here. Can I just hear what the worst songs any of you have ever had to play for weddings have been, coming from your different backgrounds?
Well, sometimes we play those worst songs. Part of our live show is to, not so much to form value judgments, but to play certain kind of wimpy songs in a wimpy style. You know, we do that as just sort of to juxtapose that against playing something as tight as possible. But we do sort of wimpy arrangements now of The Look of Love or Tie a Yellow Ribbon or There's Got to Be a Morning After or Feelings. Any of these things.
Daddy's Little Girl.
Yeah. Well, I kind of like Daddy's
I
Little
like
Girl.
I like Daddy's Little Girl.
Yeah, I'm sure it's a nice song.
We like, I guess we kind of even like these songs.
What's amazing is once you start playing this stuff, you do break down all these things you attach to it, and you start to hear great things in songs that you would never have liked. For instance, I really like the song Sweet Pea now a lot. I even like Tommy Rowe's arrangement of Sweet Pea. It's a really tight thing. There was a time when I would have thought that was the dumbest, stupidest song ever written. Knock Three Times, I think, is a great song now. Even that arrangement, that performance, Tony Orlando. I don't know if I'd want to hang out with Tony Orlando, but I like that recording of that song now, and there was a time that I didn't.
Can you do a few bars of one of these songs for us?
Oh, sure. What? You want to hear a funny arrangement of Proud Mary, for instance?
Sure, but that's maybe too good of a song. I mean,
How we play it. Here we go. Let's do a little bit of that.
Everybody do the rock and roll.
We play this as we play this in rock and roll clubs as quietly as possible. Okay? Here we go.
Okay.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Rock and roll!
Rolling
on the river.
That's enough of that.
That's fabulous.
So it goes like that. It's a good icebreaker, too. Once people see how miserable we can be, then they, you know, everybody sort of breaks the ice and we're having a good time.
What are you likely to go into after that?
Maybe we'll go into a Chemuchem, for instance, which is an Armenian folk song that we really, really, really like.
Did anybody ever play as square as that in real life?
I did a lot of hotel gigs.
Did you?
Yeah. Oh, we saved Bubba from his lounge gig. Yeah, that's what he was doing.
I got through college playing hotels and honky-tonks.
Now, on one of your records, you do The Doors, People Are Strange as a polka.
Right.
You want to do that for us?
Okay, well, this is People Are Strange, originally by The Doors, and we played as a polka, but it's actually a hora and would be very appropriate for a bar mitzvah. It's kind of a circle dance. Everybody grab hands, and here we go.
Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven now when you're down. When you're strange, faces come out of the rain. When you're strange, no one remembers your name. When you're strange, when you're strange, when you're strange. People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven. When you're unwanted, streets are uneven. Now when you're down, when you're strange, faces come out of the rain. When you're strange, no one remembers your name. When you're strange, when you're strange, when you're strange. Yeah.
Terrific. Carl, what made you realize that People Are Strange would make a perfect horror?
What made me realize that?
Yeah.
Well,
why'd you pick on that song?
Well, it seemed to be, you know, it was kind of slow. The Doors did it kind of slow, and I thought, well, one thing we can do is make it faster. And then we made it faster, and we made it faster, and now we perform it about that tempo live. And it seemed a little fast for a traditional polka, unless you're very, very good. So it looked more like something that you would see as a circle dance. And also, it's in a minor key, which sort of lends itself better to that kind of thing.
Of course.
But there are some things that don't work. You know, we try other songs sometimes as polkas or horas or cha-chas, and they don't work at all. And so we don't always just take it because it seems like a novel thing to do.
Can I get you to play a few measures of a failure?
Of a failure? Let me see. Well, what is it that we've done recently that didn't work? I remember, I know one. Bus stop, a wet day, she's there. I say we share my umbrella. Bus stop, bus goes, she stays, love grows under my umbrella. That sounds like just People Are Strange again.
Hey, that sounds pretty good.
Well, it does at first, and then the more we would play it, the more we realized that, you know, it's just not as strong, and there's too many words, and the message seems different. Somehow the message of People Are Strange is not so specific as a song like Bus Stop.
How about Hey Jude, Cha-Cha-Cha?
Well,
that works.
Would you like to hear a measure? This is pretty funny.
Yeah.
One of our fans from Oklahoma City came up to me and said, hey, Carl, I know a song that'll work as a cha-cha, and we hear that a lot. You know, people are always wanting us to work up Grateful Dead polkas, which we've never found a song yet that really works for a Grateful Dead polka. But he said, Hey Jude, Cha-Cha, and we thought about it, and it goes like this. One, a two, a one, two.
It is amazing. Has the reception your band has gotten changed in the past 11 years? Do people get what you're doing more than when you started?
I think so. I think that with world music kind of coming up also, people are more accustomed to odd sounds like the accordion or someone singing in a foreign language. Those have been the main obstacles to overcome as much as just the forms, just the fact that it's a polka. But having someone actually pay attention and listen without laughing to Bubba singing in Spanish or to hear us try to do our best with Polish or Armenian or whatever. At first, I think it was novelty to most people, and now I think people realize that we sincerely try to play these things as close to form as possible, and by that, I think that our acceptance has grown.
Well, I had a ball with the concert, and I want to thank you
thank you very much
for performing. It was just really a lot of fun.
It's our pleasure.
The band is Brave Combo, and they record on Rounder Records. They have a few albums. The latest is called Humansville. And the members of the band, again, are Carl Finch. He's the founder. We heard him on accordion, piano, and vocals. Jeffrey Barnes, tenor saxophone and clarinet. Bubba Hernandez, we heard him on bass, tuba, and vocals. And Mitch Marine on drums. Thanks to all of you. Carl, would you play us out?
Oh, okay, this is the Satellite Polka by one of our heroes, Larry Chesky from Holyoke, Massachusetts. One, two, three, four. Woo! Woo!
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. That's film music by John Lurie. Lurie starred in Down by Law and Stranger Than Paradise, two films he also wrote the music for. Lurie also founded the band The Lounge Lizards. Coming up, he tells us why he's not playing fake jazz anymore. And have you ever wondered what the Italian word is for schlemiel? Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg considers the problems of translating movies and literature. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Knoy. Hopes were dashed today that more foreign women and children would be released from Iraq and occupied Kuwait. Diplomats tried to arrange planes to ferry out dependents trapped there, but the government of Saddam Hussein insisted any country sending aircraft must give reciprocal landing rights to Iraqi planes to carry Iraqi nationals home. That type of agreement would go against United Nations sanctions against Iraq. It's very difficult to get precise information about the fate of Americans trapped in the Middle East. As Terry Phillips reports from Baghdad, even getting an exact count is not easy.
Unless an American citizen has registered with the embassy, U.S. State Department officials don't necessarily know they are here. Consequently, the numbers are a bit vague. The total in Iraq is probably not more than 600. About 2,500 Americans remain stranded in Kuwait. Of that number, at least a dozen are known to be in custody. Many of those have taken refuge in diplomatic safe havens. But dozens of Americans remain at risk of being arrested here. Life in Baghdad is getting more difficult for everyone. People are reporting shortages of bread, flour, and sugar. However, Iraq does seem to be self-sufficient with respect to fruit and vegetables. For National Public Radio, this is Terry Phillips reporting in Baghdad.
In a meeting with French President François Mitterrand today, Jordan's King Hussein reportedly laid out a plan under which U.S. and allied forces would withdraw from Saudi Arabia at the same time as Iraqi forces would leave Kuwait. An Arab peacekeeping force would replace the troops from both sides while political negotiations took place. The crisis in the Persian Gulf may be causing a realignment in the radical Palestinian movement. George Habash, a Palestinian commando leader with close ties to Syria, today declared his support for Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. NPR's Tom Jelton reports.
George Habash, leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, is considered the Palestinian leader closest to Hafez al-Assad, the president of Syria. In the Gulf crisis, Assad has sided with the United States and allied governments against Iraq, even sending forces to the region to stand against Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein, Assad's arch-rival in the Arab world. George Habash was headquartered in Syria, but today he took the side of Iraq in the Gulf crisis. Habash is visiting Iraq for the first time in 11 years, he told reporters today in Baghdad, quote, to tell the Iraqi people and leadership that we stand in one trench. Habash said he has not decided to move his commando operation base out of Damascus, but his support for Saddam Hussein will undoubtedly strain Habash's relations with his old allies in Syria. In Amman, Jordan, I'm Tom Jelton.
Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz told the head of the International Red Cross today that the organization should provide food for foreign nationals still held in Kuwait and Iraq. Aziz also said Iraq was not responsible for food shortages caused by the United Nations embargo. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. John Lurie's movie roles and music have given him the image of the ultimate downtown New York bohemian. He starred in the downbeat films Stranger Than Paradise and Down by Law. Lurie also scored both films. For the past 10 years, he's performed and recorded with his band, the Lounge Lizards. Their brand of jazz was bathed in irony, but a lot of the irony is gone in their latest record, Voice of Chunk. This is the opening track, Bob the Bob, composed by Lurie. He's featured on alto saxophone. His brother, Evan Lurie, is on piano. Compositions on your new record, like Bob the Bob, sound very influenced by world music. Have you been traveling?
Yeah, actually, it was strange. I did this little thing in Last Temptation of Christ, and
you were an apostle, right?
Yeah, I was St. James. I'm basically the beard behind Willem Dafoe is my part. I met these guys called Ganawa musicians who I'd heard about before and started playing with them. But Bob the Bob I had actually written about 2 months before that. So when I started playing with these Ganawa musicians, I found things in my own playing rather than that I was copying them. So it was kind of more, organic for me or something.
So this was in Morocco while you were shooting The Last Temptation of Christ?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you sit in with them at all?
Yeah. Well, the first thing that happened was I was looking for Ganawa musicians, and I was introduced to a bunch of guys who were not... Ganawa's got a whole spiritual background behind it, and it's not just a musical form. It's a whole lifestyle, which I don't know enough about to tell you. But there was I met some phony Ganawas, so to speak. Then I met a French guy who was a fan of my band who was doing some kind of... his military service in Morocco for some weird reason, and he had... These guys come to my room and we play almost every night. So yeah, I got to play with them a lot.
I was wondering if you felt more comfortable sitting in with them than you have with jazz musicians in America.
You know, I'm not the guy to sit in. I've always shied away from this thing of sitting in. It always seems to be a disaster. Also, the way I play doesn't really, you know, I'm not really good for a cutting contest. As I play more, I play less and less and less. I'm not really like, you know, my bebop technique is sorely lacking. So I guess I did feel more comfortable with them. I like the reason that they play music more. I like the essence of the music more. That's where my heart is, you know.
How is the reason that they play music different from the reason you think jazz musicians play music?
Well, I think I can't say why jazz musicians actually play music. For me, with jazz, I'm only really interested in the big voices and the people like Coltrane or Monk or Dolphy. But then all these hundreds of people who sound like someone else or a synthesis of three or four styles, I have no interest in this. And I don't know why they play, actually.
The sound on your new record is in some ways a different tone than the ironic, moody, film noirish kind of music you've made a lot of in the past.
Yeah.
Is this like a new direction you're heading in?
I think it's more real somehow. I think I the film noir stuff was a little bit of a pose, I'm afraid to say, or something. Or just, you know, you try and find your voice, you know, you spend a long time trying to find your voice in whatever you do, if whatever art form, or I suppose no matter what it is, you find it. And so I feel like I finally found it. I mean, I'm very proud of the last album. I never really had that feeling before where I would come out of the studio and say, oh, I'm really proud of what this was. And this one, I'm really proud. And that's why I'm doing the business thing like this, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's ironic in a way that the place where you feel you lost the pose was going to another country and getting a sense of the music there.
Yeah, see, I find in America people tend to play music as a career, and I don't think of music like that. And I think that that's very scary if you think about music is supposed to be something more than that. It's supposed to be something involved with magic and something involved with religion in some kind of way, and I think that that's really important. And in America, we seem to have lost that thread.
There is one noirish type track on your new record. I'm thinking of The Hanging.
The Hanging. I almost didn't put The Hanging on there because I felt like it didn't quite go with the rest of the material. But, you know, when you're sequencing something, I found a spot that it would fit, you know?
Tell me about writing it, when you wrote it, what you had in mind.
The Hanging in particular?
Yeah.
The Hanging was one of those ones where I was sitting on my bed watching TV. And I had the saxophone out, you know, and I was just sort of playing, and somebody said, oh, that was really nice. And I said, really? And so then I made something into it. It was no big deal. It's a little Mingus-y. And I like this thing where I always like that thing where you've got a flatted third and then you have a raised seventh. I know that that's not going to help you, but this sort of Harlem Nocturne-y kind of sound.
The term fake jazz to describe what you started doing early on,
yes,
in your career. What did you mean by that?
Oh, I don't know. It was a really unfortunate thing I did. It was, you know, we had just thrown the Lounge Lizards together on the first occasion that we played. My brother had just moved to New York, and somebody had asked me what was a good band to open for somebody, and said, oh, my band, not having a band, we threw this thing together, 6 hours of rehearsal, and we played. And for some reason, I had been known a little bit for, I had directed these Super 8 movies, and Ardo Lindsay was in the band, and he had DNA, and Anton Fier was in the band, and he was in the Feely. So we were sort of well known, but it was a joke the first night. And we finished, and suddenly it was this immense success. People went absolutely crazy. And there was all these people rushing into the dressing room after the show. I said, what do you call this music? And I said, oh, it's fake jazz. And it stuck, which, you know, if I had known it was going to stick, I would have given a little more thought to it. But
what were the bad repercussions of having it stick?
Well, see, I'm a little bit, you know, particularly this is 1979 we're talking about. And and what was happening in the jazz world was just the most... People who were either it was really incredibly indulgent stuff where people thought that they were playing like Coltrane, but they were just really doing this sort of masturbatory jazz, or else they were playing music that you could, you know, eat steak and drink wine to. And neither one was particularly interesting to me. And so I was, because basically my influence was jazz, but I didn't want to be involved in the jazz world. It seemed like a really sure death. Not just financially, but also it was like jazz was a dirty word by at this point in time.
Your early days with the Lounge Lizards coincided with the punk rock, and I was wondering if that was good timing for you, because like you played a lot of the rock clubs, and like technique wasn't really highly prized in punk. I mean, it wasn't about technique; it was about the sound and about the energy, and attitude in a way.
Yeah, but in a way. It was bad because I'm very serious about music, you know, and I do have a certain reverence to jazz. And so that it came along in punk times. What basically happened is that I had a career before while I should have been woodshedding. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so that I was suddenly in the public, but I couldn't really play that well. And so it helped and it hurt.
Do you feel like your music changed as you started getting... more at home with the instrument and more
I got more at home running the band and making the band work. Mm-hmm. I think that was more the thing.
Musician and actor John Lurie is my guest. He starred in the movies Down by Law and Stranger Than Paradise and wrote the scores for the films. His band, the Lounge Lizards, has a new record called Voice of Chunk. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Musician and actor John Lurie is my guest. Is it true that you had your two front teeth knocked out?
The left one, yeah.
Oh, the left one?
Yeah.
By a bouncer?
But he wasn't a legitimate bouncer. I don't know what the deal was. It was very shady people. Suddenly this club had a whole new set of bouncers working there, and God knows who they were. But they decided to beat me up.
Were you playing there or training?
No, I was hanging out there. It was late. I was there, and it's a silly story. They had these two bathrooms upstairs, which were never delegated to which one was a men's room and which one was a woman's room. And so my girlfriend actually had to go to the bathroom, which was a rare occasion for using the bathrooms in one of these clubs. And I was holding the door while she went to the bathroom because there was no locker. And so there's a bang on the door, and I said, just a minute. And they say, no men in the women's room, which was quite a shock to me because nobody had ever had any idea that this was actually the women's room. And I said, I'm just holding the door. You'll have to wait. And when I opened the door, there were four guys standing there, and they were all 5'10", and they all weighed 250 pounds, and they all had the same mustaches, same haircuts, and same jackets. And I said, look at that. They all look alike. And so one of them punched me. And then one of them kicked me, and then I got up like I was going to do something about it. I can't believe that. And then one of them held me, and the other one punched me in the face and knocked my tooth out.
So do you have a fake tooth now?
Yeah, but a very nice one. It's actually whiter than the rest of the teeth.
Did it change your embouchure?
Yeah, it screwed me up because I had to actually have 8 different front teeth before I could get it back. It did change my play. It was very hard to get used to a new front tooth because, you know, the way the mouthpiece rests on your teeth, it has to be really, your teeth get worn down to the shape of the mouthpiece, and so Yeah, switching was incredibly difficult.
Do you want to do more acting? And do you want to do more than the kind of roles that you've done? In other words, not have a certain type of character that you always play?
Yeah. I certainly would like to do something other than those kind of offbeat beatniks that I've played. But acting is not, you know, I feel a little bit like a jerk saying, yeah, I want to act. I mean, I don't really have, I haven't sort of paid my dues, you know, uh-huh. as an actor. And I really go, though I definitely am acting, I go by such a natural thing. I just, if I could do it more, I think I could be great. But I don't do it enough. And I don't really have the time to pursue it.
Your music is really considered a part of the New York downtown scene. Where are you from?
I was born in Minneapolis. Then I moved to New Orleans when I was 6. And then I moved to Worcester, Massachusetts when I was around 10. I've been in New York forever, as far as 74 or something like that.
Now, your father had been a museum curator and college professor when you were in Minnesota, is that right?
Uh-huh.
And he was blacklisted? What for?
For being in the Communist Party. But that's not all exactly true. He wasn't really blacklisted. He just had to move around very quickly because he was in trouble. But he didn't actually get blacklisted.
And what did he do after the blacklist?
He had this idea. He did a lot of different stuff. He finally ended up doing selling Israeli bonds, of all things. Yeah, I don't know. See, my dad was this very, very secretive man, and so when he died, I didn't know that much about him, and so now I'm just sort of piecing together things about him and can't really, I don't really know what the whole deal was with my dad.
Were your parents, like, more politically motivated and goal-oriented than you were when you were young?
It's hard to say. My father was this very strange man, and when he died, I felt like that he had been a failure because he had never accomplished anything truly artistic. And apparently, he had gone, you know, to Columbia and NYU and written. They expected him to be the next James Joyce or something, as far as I could understand. And then he went to the South and organized farm workers and never actually wrote a book or anything. Now, I felt like my father was a bit of a failure when he died. Went to a wedding about 3 years after he died, and all these 60 and 70-year-old men were coming over to me and saying, your father was a real hero of mine, which kind of blew me away. But I think it instilled in me some kind of need, for example, why I'm doing the record, why I'm doing this 1-800-44-CHUNK business, is because I feel like you can't just do the work and then let it sit there and nobody knows it. You have to get it out there. And it instilled some kind of drive in me to make things recognized or something.
Mm-hmm. You're selling the record through an 800 number, though I think the record's in stores now, too, isn't it?
It's in some stores, yeah. But mm-hmm. you can receive the record by calling 1-800-44-CHUNK, which is also the name of the record company.
What did you decide to handle it yourself?
That's a hard question. I thought it would be fun. I was just really sick of very bad distribution that I'd had before with other labels. And I paid for this record myself, and paid for the record myself because the band was just really ripe to record these things. And I knew if I started to, you know, I didn't have a label at the time. I knew that it would take, you know, it takes between the lawyers and all this stuff. It takes 3, 4, 5 months to get it ready to go, you know. And so I just decided I'll do it now. It's time, you know. And so I did it, and I thought, this is a great album. It's going to be a breeze to sell this, you know. And, of course, in Japan and in Germany and around the world, I had people bidding on it, you know, 4, 5, 6 companies in each country. And in the United States, they wouldn't return my calls, you know, or Valerie Goodman's calls, who was doing the bid. I was kind of shocked by this because I had people who were really chasing me for this record. And in America, so I said, well, I'm not going to grovel. I've been around too long. There's really no reason for them to not. There's some kind of problem. I'm not going to take this personally. It's some kind of real problem with the system of how music is being distributed in this country. And so I'm going to just do it myself. I'll kick these guys in the pants a little bit.
Well, John Lurie, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Okay.
Actor, musician, and composer John Lurie. The latest Lounge Lizards record is called Voice of Chunk. You can also catch Lurie in the movie Wild at Heart. This is Fresh Air. This is Linda Wertheimer. Today on All Things Considered, we will be watching Iraq and the hostages still being held in that country, and we'll have conversations with some of the hostages who've returned to the United States just in the last few hours. And we'll be paying attention to some of the activities of Labor Day, a Zydeco festival in southwest Louisiana. And on this Labor Day, we'll consider the American attitude toward work. Apparently, most Americans like their work. And we'll spend a little time doing what a lot of people will be doing this Labor Day weekend, barbecuing. We'll talk to two men who've written a cookbook called The Thrill of the Grill. That's on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Translators give us access to the books and movies of other cultures. But what are we missing when we read the translation of Crime and Punishment? And what are Europeans missing when they see dubbed versions of Woody Allen movies? Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg has some thoughts on the art of translation.
My friend Letizia earns her living translating English language books and movies into Italian, usually for pitiful fees and under imminent deadlines. When I lived in Rome, she used to call me at odd hours with queries about words that she couldn't find in the dictionary. I remember when she was translating the script of the movie True Confessions, which was thick with 1940s police jargon. The Italians do these films with overdubbing, not subtitles. One night, we spent an hour looking for an Italian equivalent for slasher that had exactly two syllables, so the actor's lips and the soundtrack would stay in sync. Letizia's problem with slasher is an example of the most notorious difficulty that translators have to deal with when a word or phrase in the original language has no equivalent in the new one. What does an Italian translator do when she comes to Philip Roth's use of schlemiel in Portnoy's Complaint? If she's cautious, she could go with some rough equivalent like the Italian word for fool. But that loses the spice of the original and leads to that bland style that often makes translations read as if you're hearing the original text over a bad telephone connection. Or she can look for a colloquial equivalent in the new language. But that has its perils, too, because colloquial words can often sound comical in the mouth of a foreign character. There's a nice example in a passage from Francis Stiegmiller's translation of Madame Bovary, where Emma is coming to grips with her mounting frustration with her husband Charles. It reads, "She went into the hall, opened the window, and took a breath of fresh air to calm herself. It's pathetic," she whispered to herself, despair in her heart. "What a booby." But things aren't just lost in translation. Sometimes they're added, particularly when the new language forces the translator to say more than is explicit in the original. This is what translators like Letizia have to deal with when they render an English language book or movie into one of the European languages that makes a distinction between the familiar and formal ways of saying you. Italian does this with tu and lei, French with tu and vous, Spanish with tu and usted, German with du and sie, and so on. This means that every time somebody in an English language movie refers to somebody else as you, the translator has to make a decision about the social relationship between the characters. This may require some delicate switching. In the Italian version of Superman, Clark Kent addresses Lois Lane with a familiar tu. But when he changes to Superman, he uses the more formal pronoun lei, since Lois and the Man of Steel have a less intimate relationship. Of course, once Lois learns Clark's identity in Superman 2, he starts using the intimate form even in his Superman role. As a general rule, characters switch from formal to familiar address after their first kiss, but there are exceptions. In the Italian Casablanca, for example, Humphrey Bogart at first addresses Ingrid Bergman with a formal pronoun when she shows up in Rick's cafe, as if he doesn't want to acknowledge their earlier intimacy back in Paris. And for some reason, the Italian translator of Hitchcock's Vertigo has Jimmy Stewart addressing Kim Novak with a formal lei throughout the film, even in the second half when he's making love to her. In both cases, the choice of the pronoun lends a delicate nuance to the relationship one that's only implicit in the English versions. It's a nice reminder of how a translation is always a particular interpretation of the original. There's a well-known Italian adage that goes, traduttore, traditore, translator, traitor. And yet, sometimes, what translators betray is the truth.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Fresh Air is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Richard Parker, Thad Kirk, and Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, why the godfather of soul is also the most influential living musician in America. We talk with Bruce Tucker, who co-wrote James Brown's autobiography. Also, the neurotic humor of Stephen Wright. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.